And it is today's Topical Currents, Tuesday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Well, today we visit with writer Bob Berg. His latest work is Adversaries into Allies, How to Win People Over Without Manipulation or Coercion. He gives strategies on how anyone can become an expert on influence. Also, his advice on how to avoid manipulation from others we'll touch on. And he joins us from Jupiter, Florida. Welcome to you, Bob Berg.
Well, hello. It's great to be with you all.
Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So why don't we begin where you do? Your book is about these mastering these five simple, you call them, principles of what you call the ultimate influence. Tell us, what is ultimate influence?
Sure. Well, you know, influence itself on a very basic level is simply the ability to move a person or persons to a desired action, usually within the context of a specific goal. I call ultimate influence the ability to get what you want from others while helping them feel genuinely good about themselves, about the situation, and about you. So it's a matter of not one person winning at another's expense, but everybody coming out ahead.
Now, in Bonnie's short promotional spot for this program, we said that you could discuss the ways we can talk our way out of a traffic ticket. Well, good luck. So the FHP is behind you.
Well, it's interesting that in doing this, it's really a matter of showing genuine respect to the officer and knowing a few things what to do. I actually learned the first part of this from a former state trooper.
Oh.
Yeah, and combining that with some of the principles that I teach in the book, and not only has it worked for me, I hate to say because I feel bad that the situation even had to come up, but I can't tell you how many emails I get from people who said they used this exactly as I said, and they were able to avoid a ticket. Now, when it won't work is if you're driving recklessly, driving to endanger.
Yeah, if you're really doing something crazy.
But we're talking about when you do something that, maybe you didn't come to that complete stop, or maybe your foot is a little too hard on the pedal, and it's not public enemy crime number one, but it certainly is ticket worthy, and you've been pulled over. And so yes, if you utilize, and I can run through it if you'd like.
Yeah, please.
Well, wait a minute, Mr. Berg. Here we are. I'm a state trooper. I pulled you over. I want to see your license, your registration, and proof of insurance. How do you start formulating a defense for that?
It actually begins a little bit before that. When you see the flashing blues in your rearview mirror or you hear the siren, of course, you would pull over as soon as you safely can. And if it's at night, make sure you put the inside car lights on and then put your hands on the 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock position of the wheel and stay perfectly still as the officer approaches your car. The most dangerous time of a police officer's shift is when they are approaching the driver's side of a vehicle they've just pulled over because they don't know who's in that car. Mm-hmm. So what you've done is you've empathized with their position. You've shown them genuine respect. You're basically communicating to them that, hey, I know that while you're out here protecting and serving, you're putting yourself in harm. And so I'm showing you the proper respect is basically what you're communicating.
And I don't have a firearm to use.
Exactly, yes, that you're not a threat. And so that's the first thing. Now, when they do, they come over, obviously greet with the respect and so forth. Now, when they say, do you realize you were going, X amount of miles in a so-and-so zone? Well, the first thing you do is you'd say, yes, I do. I do realize that, and I apologize. Now, if this is true, what you can say is, I didn't realize it until I saw the lights in the mirror, and I looked down, and you're absolutely right. I was going that speed. I apologize. So what you've done right there is, aside from continuing to show respect, you didn't lie. They've heard every lie in the book, and they don't believe any of them. So what you've done is you've separated yourself again from everyone else.
Like the one that says, oh, my wife just went into labor, and she just called me, and I have to go pick her up.
Exactly. So that's a really good start that you're progressing along. Now, right there, that may be enough. But what you might do if you feel as though you still need to kind of work with this a little bit is just to say, officer, again, I was going that speed. There's no excuses. I take full responsibility. This isn't something I usually do, and I'm wondering if it would be appropriate if I could get away with a warning this time.
Mm-hmm.
So again, with respect, you're framing it correctly. You're also using what I call the out or the back door. You're saying, if appropriate. So you're not coming across as though you're trying to coerce or bully, but instead you're leaving it in their hands, but you're making your case in a very polite and respectful way. Now, this is all adding up to probably, you know, there's a good chance that you're going to get off with just a warning, but what you could do is utilize what I call the 8 keywords of practically always move someone to your side of the issue, providing you've set it up correctly with patience and politeness and respect, and that is to say, if you can't do it, I'll definitely understand. And when you do this, again, you're giving that person the out, you're showing absolute respect, but you're also saying, you know, I do believe you can, but it is totally up to you, and you are more important. You're of more value than the result.
And now, so I'm sorry, go on. No, please.
No, I was just going to say, you've done at that point everything you can. Now, there's no guarantee you're going to get out of that ticket, but the chances are very, very good.
I'm just wondering, because by its very nature, the title of your book is How to Win Over People Without Manipulation or Coercion, and we know there's a huge difference between persuasion and manipulation, which we can talk about, but isn't it manipulative to be doing all this for the sole purpose of getting out of a ticket?
I don't believe so. I mean, I would like to think that a person can learn their lesson, you know, without having to have the ticket. There's really no reason to have one if you can possibly not. Of course, the best thing is to not go over the speed limit and come to that complete stop. But, you know, we're talking about life, and if we can learn a lesson without getting a ticket, no, and I don't believe it's manipulation. I think you're looking to persuade, you're looking to influence, but I don't see it as a negative.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, that's 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, and also email, that's radio@WLRN.org, if you'd like to speak with us, and also Bob Berg, the author of Adversaries into Allies.
So I'm just wondering, you know, I want to address your five principles one by one, but before we do you think that it requires a great deal of self-awareness to even understand, no less tackle these things, these five principles?
Here's the thing, Bonnie. It does take that. We need to be aware, because without awareness, we're not going to do any of these things. And the reason why many people are not good when it comes to influence and positive persuasion and some of these things is because they're not conscious that there's even an issue involved.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, someone does something, pushes a button, boom, that's it. And
exactly.
You know, and that's not the way to be effective. It's not the way effective people act.
So basically, what you're hoping to do with your book is not only just give these five principles, but raise awareness of these five things that are within all of us.
Yes, that's a great way of looking at it. And and it's up to the person to be aware. Not, I think most people, if they would like the benefits that a book like this can provide, such as being more effective, such as being able to be more productive, being able to make more money, enjoy what they do more, have better family relationships, they're going to probably think, well, it might be worth it to be aware and to make sure that I keep. So you'll notice that several times in the book I talk about conscious awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Berg, let me set up this scenario, which I'm sure many of our listeners have faced too. You're at Publix, you're in the speed lane, and somebody ahead of you has 15 items, and the clerk, the cashier, isn't making any effort to put a stop to that. If you're behind them, how would you handle that? Or would you just let it go?
It depends on the situation. I mean, if you're really in a rush and you have got to get to where you're going, and you think it's worthwhile to bring something up, you can politely say something like, you know, pardon me, and I don't mean to be rude in any way, but I believe you have more than the 10 items. And I wouldn't say anything except for I'm personally in a rush, which is why I only got these 10 items. And when you do that in that sort of way, then it's up to everybody to respond accordingly. They may or may not. I would say that, you know, unless it's a situation where you are in a total rush and it can't be avoided, what you'd usually do, you let it take place, and then you talk to the person, the cashier, and let them know, in a nice way, in a tactful way, that the reason for the 10 is because there are people in a hurry who purposely got less than. Now, if you don't feel as though that's going to do any good, you may have to address that with the manager, but you want to do it in a way that you don't get that person in trouble either, because there's nothing good about doing that.
But you also don't go into their cart and stay 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
No, you don't. Not if you want to be as effective as you can be. But you know, again, there's nothing magical, and I think it's that there's always a cost benefit analysis that we have to go through. And a lot of times, unless it's something that is a real urgent thing, no, you're probably not going to say anything, and there's no reason to. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't say something to the cashier politely and kindly afterwards, or to the manager.
We're going to get to the first of these, which is controlling one's emotions. But first, we need to take a short break. We're speaking to Bob Berg. He's a professional speaker, author of several books, and his most recent is Adversaries into Allies, How to Win People Over Without Manipulation or Coercion. We'll be right back. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Bob Berg. That's B-U-R-G. He's an author of the most recently, Adversaries into Allies, How to Win People Over Without Manipulation or Coercion. So I'd like to start with this first principle. We're all pretty emotional human beings. I mean, all of us have our emotions. And you say that controlling them didn't come naturally to you, but that you need to control your emotions in order to be effective. So how did you learn to control your emotions?
Sure, that's where it starts. Because really, only when you can control your emotions are you in a position where you can be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. And as you said, we are emotional beings as human beings. Yeah, we're logical, but we're very emotional. And it's okay. I mean, emotions are a terrific part of life. But as one of my friends, Don DiScumaci, says, sure, take your emotions along for the ride, but make sure you're driving the car. In other words, we need to be in control of our emotions, not they in control of us. With me, I had to really work at it. And one of the things I did was first understand why it was important. Because when I reacted out of anger, when I reacted unthinkingly, I was never as effective as I could be. Once I knew that was an issue, I then began to really work on it. I became, as you mentioned earlier, you brought up the word awareness. Mm-hmm. I became aware. Hey, I took yellow sticky notes and I wrote them. I wrote the word respond instead of react, as I talk about in the book. Respond all over the place, and I put them in the bathroom mirror, and I put them by my telephone, and I put them everywhere I could see them. And I began to just get that really into my head and into my heart. Another thing I suggest in the book is rehearse. Just like an astronaut will simulate a mission hundreds of times before actually going up into space, so that when something unexpected happens, which is part of life, they've already been there, they've done that. And it's the same when you can picture, if you know certain people who sort of push your buttons a little bit, or certain circumstances that you're more likely to be reactive rather than responsive, picture those, rehearse those, play those out in your mind's eye, so that when the actual instance takes place, you've already been there. You're already familiar with it. Now you can very easily go into response mode.
You mean like someone slipping in and stealing a parking space?
Yes, exactly like that.
You can see all of Joe's pet peeves. We've heard three of them now so far. But
that's right.
Yeah, there they are. But sometimes the unexpected does occur and will occur no matter how many times you rehearse, you know? So, and they do get the best of us sometimes. So let's say we react instead of respond and they're out of the bag, you know, we've done it. So then where do we go from there? Can we still rectify the situation?
Well, you can, but certainly it's not quite as easy. And you need to be able to, and again, this depends on the situation, but you, in the context of who this is, but you need to take hold of yourself and apologize. And not make an excuse, but simply apologize. And that's it. And you move on.
If I may ask, how long have you been working on these principles yourself in your own life?
Oh, let's see, there was last week, the week before, about 25 years.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. We're speaking to Bob Berg, and maybe you have situations you'd like to talk about. We haven't gotten to all of his principles yet for this ultimate influence, but you can join us at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, or email radio@WLRN.org.
And we have a first caller, Lisa in Miami. Hi, Lisa. How are you?
Hi. How are you guys doing?
What does it take to get your goat, Lisa?
I'm sorry?
What would it take to get your goat?
You mean to get upset? I don't get upset. I have complete control over myself. No, I get upset just like everyone else. Miami drivers drive me crazy.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It's, you know, you have to have ultimate control and patience when you're driving around here, let alone doing anything in the Tri-County area. But I wanted to call to really comment on my admiration for this book. I had never heard of this until I was listening to the program on my way home from work today. And this is actually something that I do in my everyday life. My friends always make fun of me because I will get things for free, or I will get into places that no one else can go to, or I'll get tours of situations, or just really kind gestures from people just because I'm friendly and I'm happy. I smile, I say thank you, I greet people, I genuinely treat others like they matter. Even the person that's bagging my groceries at Publix, mm-hmm. to the server at my restaurant, just realizing that their role in life allows me to do mine.
Mm-hmm. Right on, Lisa.
Yeah.
Sounds like Lisa should have written this book.
Well, you can co-author the next one.
I hate to go back to the grocery store, but a couple of weeks ago, I was in the speed lane, and I put the little dividing stick between orders for the next person. And this woman said, "Oh, that's so kind of you." And I was like, "Well, it doesn't seem like that big a deal to me." But she thought that was really a very act of kindness.
Well, her frame, and she had a frame, as Lisa was talking about. And what is a frame? Frame is simply the foundation from which everything else emanates. So if you look at things in a way that, and she looked at what you did as an act of kindness, and by her doing that, and her assuming that, she actually set a frame of allies with you, so that you could then say, "Oh, my pleasure," or however you responded, and it right away sets a frame of friendship rather than adversary. So a lot of that is just proactively deciding. And what's interesting is when you decide to assume someone else is being helpful and kind, that's not what changes them. That would be magical thinking. That's not what changes them. What it does is it changes you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what changes them. Because when Lisa smiles at that person who's the waiter, that waiter feels good about Lisa, and treats Lisa in a nice way and does more for Lisa. And I can't tell you how many times that when I've greeted as a speaker, I fly all over the place, so I live in hotels, and when I greet the person at the desk, with a good evening, and it's a sincere one, and they say, "Wow, you're the first one all day." They're going out of their way to take care of me. Now, that's not why I do it. That's simply the result of doing it.
Lisa. In fact, you have a chapter called Compliment the Uncomplimented.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, going back to Lisa, that's sort of what she was talking about in a way. It's really respecting everyone, and especially those people who usually aren't complicated.
Complimented.
Complimented. When you can compliment them genuinely, find something about them that, wow, what a difference it makes in their world. And again, not only are they going to go out of their way for you, but even if they didn't, if you don't need it, it doesn't matter. It's that you did something nice for someone. And here's the interesting thing, and Harv Eker talks about this in his excellent book, Secrets of the Millionaire Mind. How you do anything is how you'll do everything. So don't worry about being nice or kind because someone can do something for you. First, it's the wrong reason, but it doesn't even matter. It's that if you practice doing it when you don't need to, you're going to do it naturally when you really do need the results.
Well, mm-hmm. Gentle Lisa, is there anything else we can do for you?
I am just have such a pleasure of speaking with you all today. I can't wait to read this book.
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
I hope you enjoy
it.
Okay, thank you, Lisa. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
You too. So, Bob, I'd like to get back to the frame, which is the third one. We skipped over the second for now. What if we encounter a situation where the frame or the framework has already been set? Mm-hmm. Can we
reset
change
the frame.
Yeah. Okay, and how do we do that?
And that's important. Sometimes we have to reset the frame. Let me give you a quick example.
Okay.
I was pulling into the parking lot of a hotel where I had a meeting, and I was pulling into the parking space, and I really wasn't paying as much attention as I should have been. It was my fault. I nearly hit a guy as he was getting out the driver's side of his car. Now, I stopped short in plenty of time, but he was startled, and he shot a look at me. Wow, if looks could kill.
Mm-hmm.
He was very angry. Hey, who could blame him, But what happened was he set a frame, obviously, unconsciously in this case, but he set a frame of anger and of hostility. And had I bought into that frame, into that premise, I might have looked back, what are you looking at? And he'd have said, watch where you're going. At best, it would have been uncomfortable. At worst, it could have been a really ugly situation. But what I did is I responded rather than reacted. I did not buy into the frame. And what I did is I put my hand up to wave, through the windshield, and I smiled an apologetic smile, and I mouthed the words, sorry. And immediately he went, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, it sometimes is just as simple and as easy as that. If you don't buy into the other person's negative frame, but rather reset the frame, they're usually, and I'll tell you, in any potentially difficult interpersonal situation, a frame will be set. The only question is, who's going to set the frame, you or them? And if they set it, you're taking a chance based on just simply on luck that this person's even going to understand this concept, which they probably don't, and that they're going to take the time to make sure they set a productive frame. So it's better when you can make the decision to set the frame.
And let's move along to another caller. This is Larry in Miami. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I'm a disabled person in a wheelchair, and I need the van-accessible parking spaces when I go to, the grocery. But so often they're filled with other cars, and oftentimes there'll be, a large truck on the really big wheels parked in one of them, and I'll see, a young, healthy man come walking out, no problems, and climb up into his truck and drive away. And I want to ask these people sometimes, what's your disability that you need that parking space? But I don't want to just be confrontational about it. I want mm-hmm. to understand in case I'm missing something.
Well, Larry, I appreciate your attitude, that you realize intuitively that being confrontational about it probably isn't going to accomplish anything. You might make the person feel bad and think about it for now, but probably someone who's done that is just not thinking anyway, or they don't care. So what you could, if you want to say something, and I'm not even saying you necessarily should, but if you want to, just to say, excuse me, and they look at you and they say, yeah, and you say, I don't in any way mean to offend you, but I'm just wondering if perhaps you might have missed that was a handicapped spot.
That's pretty, how can they miss it?
Right, well, exactly, of course. But so what you're doing is you're saying it in a tactful way that here's what you're doing. You're not being confrontational. Mm-hmm. You're not giving a you message like, hey, buddy, you're wrong, or you're this, or you're stupid, or you're inconsiderate, because the person's going to be defensive. Remember, the ego comes into play. People don't want to admit they're wrong. But instead, if you're polite like that and you give it an I message, I was wondering, if you happen to see that was a handicapped spot, or if perhaps, you didn't, well, whatever. And when you do it like that, that person most likely is going to come back and say, you know what, I am so sorry, I didn't think of that. I won't do that again. Because remember, you didn't put him in a position where he has to save face.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Bob, Bob Berg. He's a speaker and author of Adversaries into Allies, How to Win People Over Without Manipulation or Coercion. One another break. We'll come back and take more of your calls.
And we return 33 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and also writer Bob Berg joining us from Jupiter, Florida. He's written the book Adversaries into Allies. Bob, what if the other person has really committed something which deserves castigation?
It depends on the situation. If possible, when you can castigate in private and applaud in public, that's always the best way to do it. But again, it depends on the situation, what the person did, and
letting them save face.
that's always the best thing to do, if you possibly can. Because remember, the ego really does come into play, and a person doesn't want to feel shamed. They don't want to feel stepped on, put down, pushed around. And so to the degree that you can, you know, I always say giving the person an out or a back door, giving them an escape hatch. And when we do that, the person's much more likely to actually take the action that we desire.
Such as Larry with the person parking in the handicap space.
Exactly. That was a great question by Larry. And I empathize just because it's you know, a tough thing to be disabled and have someone take your space, and you think, oh my goodness, do people even think? And the answer is no, a lot of times they don't.
No.
Well, we won't get into healthy people getting out of cars with handicapped.
Well, that's what
stickers.
He's talking about.
But let's go to Margaret. She's in Hollywood. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, I just wanted to make two observations. The premise of the book is brilliant, and it's been something that just intuitively I've been trying to do for many years.
Thank you, Margaret.
The challenge that I put out is that there are times when someone is so clearly in the wrong, and in trying to give them, you know, this space-saving option, it can be really hard not to come off sarcastic when it's obvious that, you know, you have 15 items in a 10-item or less lane, and I'm saying, gee, do you think? So that's my challenge, and I think it's probably something a lot of people implementing the strategies will find can be the challenge. And the other thing I wanted to point out is it is really important for parents to teach kids from the time they're little the same strategies, because they will find any reasonable request asked in a reasonable way, in a reasonable tone of voice, is oftentimes likely to yield the desired result. So whether you're asking a teacher for an extra day or two on an assignment that you're late on, or, you know, a classmate to stop poking your head with a pen, it's just really important that kids be taught these strategies too, because it's just never too soon to learn how to.
That's a good point, Margaret.
Excellent point. Excellent point. In terms of, you know, the frustration we go to when someone is so clearly in the wrong, absolutely. In a sense, it's great practice for us to the degree that we can keep our head when we know that the other person is really clearly just being rude or wrong or what have you. That actually strengthens us and equips us to be able to handle these situations. But sure, it's very difficult, and these things, you know, frustrate me when I see people doing this. So, you know, we're all human, and I think it's very natural to be kind of miffed when someone does something that really is just unthinking and so forth. So I absolutely agree with Margaret, and I love what she said about with children. I actually have a few stories in there about kids who, mm-hmm. more intuitively than anything else, did use these principles and how well it works. So yes, as soon as the children are of any kind of learning age, when they can be introduced to this, and again, like with me, you know, I got to see my dad, and I was blessed with just wonderful parents, and to this day, I just adore them. My dad, though, just really had those people skills, and it was natural for him. And I got to observe him, how he was genuinely interested in other people, in making them feel genuinely good about themselves and bringing out their best. And so I got to learn from a great example. I didn't always embrace it, but when I was ready, I came back to that, and it was very helpful to me.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, even before they're able to, you're able to teach them, actually, you do teach by setting an example and by being that person.
Let's move along to another caller. This is Jose in Miami. Hi.
Hello.
Hello, go ahead.
Okay. I'm just calling on the whole notion about sociopaths, and not the stigmatized version, the Hollywood version of, you know, a psycho killer, just everyday sociopaths. I feel
just
like...
Just unfeeling.
Yeah, on missing those social cues, on just genetically being hardwired not to feel emotions, and to me, from studying sociopaths, it seems like intelligent conscious awareness, which Mr. Berg is talking about, just sounds like sociopathic manipulation. I feel like there is no difference, and I don't want to attach the stigma of a sociopath, because pop culture usually ties it to Patrick Batemans and blah, blah, blah. Sociopaths aren't necessarily cold-hearted killers. They're just, they see the world in different eyes. So I want to know, is there a difference between intelligent, conscious persuasion to sociopathic manipulation?
Jose, I certainly hope so. Unless there's something I'm really not aware of. But no, this is, you know, basically when you're doing this, you are caring about the other person. One of the principles is communicate with tact and empathy. And to have empathy, you must be able to, you know, if not totally understand how that person feels, because we don't always understand how another person feels. We all come from different belief systems. But we can certainly understand that they are feeling something and that something is distressing to them. And hopefully we can communicate to them that we're there to help them through that. So, no, that's certainly not something I would agree with that premise, though I certainly appreciate you sharing that with us.
Bob Berg, something that struck me in your book was that you talked about the power of a handwritten note. Mm-hmm. And these days, with all of the emails and texting, that really gets attention.
It really does. And what's interesting is I learned this and was doing this before the internet. I'll be 56 next month. So, I was doing this long before then, and it was effective even then because very few people still wrote handwritten notes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with the proliferation of the internet, of course, with email, social media, and everything, wow, you know, how often does that happen now? So I talk about in the book, absolutely, after you meet someone, when you can send a personalized handwritten thank you note, what a huge difference it makes. And by the way, we were talking about kids again, and Margaret had brought up, I talk about suggesting to your children after they go for a job interview, sending a handwritten note to the person who interviewed them, thanking them for their time and consideration. And when you do that, when I was a kid, my dad had me do that. I used to get jobs because of it, because I took that time to write that handwritten note.
I used to complain of having to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go to that belief system, understanding the clash of belief systems principle, because you just mentioned it. So the question is, how do we understand someone else's belief system when most of us don't even understand our own? They're mostly, you know, unconscious.
You're so correct. What is a belief? Well, a belief is a subjective truth. It's the truth as we understand the truth to be, which doesn't mean it's the truth. It means it's our truth.
Mm-hmm.
And this belief system is a combination of upbringing, environment, schooling, news media, television, movies, popular entertainment, mores, everything we touch, taste, hear, see, smell. And it's basically given to us without our knowledge, of course, from the time we're a baby. You know, and we accept what we see, what we hear, what we learn, and we don't critically think, now, why is that true? You know, what's the premise there? No, we just accept it. And so most of us, well, all of us, we grew up with a belief system that we had nothing to do with forming, and most people are never conscious that they are basically run by an operating system that they had nothing to do with creating.
Exactly.
Now, the other person is the same. They're also run by a belief system that they had nothing to do with creating. So you've got two people maybe about to have an interpersonal situation, both based on their belief. Now, as human beings, we also tend to believe that everybody else sees the world as we see the world. This is why you hear people saying, oh, everybody feels that way. Nobody likes that. Everyone, right? Because we just think of, well, if we do, obviously, normal is what I am, so everybody else must feel the same way. So here's what we need to do. And when I say understand the clash of belief systems, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to understand their belief system. As you said, we might not even understand our own. What we can do is we can understand that they are probably coming from a belief system that's much different than ours. They see the world a lot differently than we do. And as long as we understand this, now we've created an environment where we can, again, think, and we can respond, and we can act accordingly so that everyone can come out ahead.
So before we go to our break and take more calls, I want you to tell the story. I love that you love animals. And to tell the story of Liberty, who was once a stray cat, who became your cat, and how this clash of systems of belief came into play with Liberty.
Well, with Liberty, she was either she was stray or feral. We're still not sure, but she was wandering around the neighborhood, looked very skinny, and so my neighbor had saw her first, Terry, and told me, and so I brought out some got some cat kibble and tried to feed her, and she was so scared of humans that she wouldn't come near it. So we stood far back, and of course she ate when she knew she was not in danger, and we did this for a couple of days. Then what I started to do was I would place the bowl with the kibble in it a little bit closer to my home every time, but I'd still stand far away so she could see me but saw that there was no danger. So in other words, she kind of had a back door. She had an out. And then eventually I would put the bowl inside my patio, but again, I'd leave the door open so she knew she had an escape hatch.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd keep bringing it closer to the door that separated the patio from the bedroom. And then I'd open it up, and she'd actually start eating even with her head actually in the house, as long as, again, the doors were open. Now, what I eventually did is I wanted to try to get her learning to eat inside, because I definitely wanted her to be my cat, and I wanted to be her human. And so I started to close the door slowly. And as soon as she saw me do it, she looked back as though to run. So what I did is immediately opened the door even wider. And as soon as she knew she had the escape hatch, she was fine. Now, we did this a couple more times, and eventually she let me close the door behind her. And, and she'd come in whenever she wants to. She'd hang around. She'd eat, and so forth. And she's great. Now, the same is with humans. It's not that she wanted to escape, okay? It's that she wanted to know she could. And so often it's the same when we're in the act of influencing another human being. It's not that they want to say no. It's not that they want to disagree. It's not that they don't want to necessarily do what we're suggesting. They just want to know they have the choice. So Berg's law of the out or back door simply says the bigger the out or back door you give someone to take, the less they'll feel the need to take it.
And, of course, then she brought you, speaking of different systems of belief, she brought you the mouse head.
Right.
Which was her way of showing her love.
Right. It was her way of providing value in a way that I didn't necessarily see as being of value. So I posted on my Facebook page that my stray cat, Liberty, just brought me a dead mouse head, and that the head looked very much like a miniature version of the horse's head from The Godfather, and I wrote, I wonder what she's trying to tell me. Now, usually when I put something on my Facebook page that I think is profound, I get 3 responses. Well, I got like 75 responses on this, of course, because it's about a cat. And there was actually some good pieces of advice, such as, well, just understand that because she sees it of value, that alone should be of value.
Yes, life's lessons.
Yeah, exactly.
We're speaking with Bob Berg. He is the author of Adversaries into Allies. Let's take that last break, and we'll be back with your calls.
And it is today's polite edition of Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and writer Bob Berg, author of Adversaries into Allies. We'll move along. We have a Key West caller. This is Joe. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
I just wanted to make a comment talking about belief systems. And as a Canadian that has lived in Key West for 13 years now, I understand now that empathy, manners, kindness, these are things that are cultural. And there's a belief that Canadians are, just very nice people. I understood that as a Canadian traveling, but as a Canadian now living in the States, I recognize it more and more and more where I see and recognize Canadians because they are so kind, polite manners, and I always find it interesting. I hope that I'm not losing that from being here so long, and I try not to, but it's something that I didn't see as much as a Canadian living in Canada or understand, but as a Canadian living in the States, certainly appreciate respect, and I find it a nice thing that people always tend to comment on.
There's also sort of the same feeling about, say, people from the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And Canadians, Joe, Canadians do tend to be very, very polite people. I actually mentioned that at one part in the book, and I always enjoy speaking up in Canada. And I think there's a lot of very polite U.S. citizens as well, and people all over the world. It's interesting, Joseph. I agree with you. I'll go to places in the Midwest, whether it's a Columbus, Ohio, or someplace in it could be Fargo, North Dakota, or Sioux Falls. They do. There does tend to be a different type of a more relaxed, a polite type of attitude. So
when they say "have a nice day," they really mean it.
Yeah, Minneapolis is another place where I just love the people of Minnesota. I mean, they just are just wonderful people. So I think everywhere you go, there's the good, the bad, and the ugly. But there's certain cultures I think do put different emphasis on certain things.
Bob, Kim Weiss wants to give a shout out to you and
say I love Kim Weiss.
That you're a man who truly walks your talk, and everything he's discussing is exemplary of how he treats people.
Oh, that is very nice. Better tell that to Jose, by the way, who's pretty convinced that I'm a psychopath?
No, sociopath.
Excuse me. Yeah.
No, he didn't say you. He didn't say you were Ted Bundy or anything.
Oh, Kim's wonderful. She is with Health Communications, and she is just an absolute delight as a human being.
Let's move along to another caller, Gail in Boynton Beach. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
During the program, what I'd like to comment is very briefly on a couple of items. First of all, people like to be acknowledged as a person.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in Paris for over 4 years, and when you go into a bakery, you always acknowledge the person behind the counter and say, "Bonjour, monsieur, bonjour, madame." Here you go into Einstein's and you just say to the person, "I'd like a half a dozen bagels."
Go ahead.
And so people won't, here I find in the States, and I'm born and bred in Boston, people don't acknowledge what we would call as service people. In other words, another day recently I was at the doctor's office. As I was signing in at the counter, I looked at the receptionist. I said, "Hi, so how has your day been going so far?" And she said, "Oh, not so bad, but thank you for your asking." Mm-hmm. And she turned around to the other gals sitting around and she says, "I think she's the first person who's asked us today. In fact, I don't remember the last time anybody ever asking us that question."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And people around, I think in the United States many times, and I've lived in Atlanta, home of bless your heart and all of that, may do the same thing. I think it's just how you were brought up, a lot of it. My mother used to say you get more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. I remember my dad going through the Mass Pike toll booth in the middle of winter, and as he was getting this ticket from the gentleman, he would say in the middle of winter in a blizzard, "Well, how are the mosquitoes biting today?" And people just don't treat a lot of other people as their other humans, I find.
Yeah, let me comment on this, if I may, and I appreciate that point very
also
much.
Also, tips help.
Hmm?
Tips help also.
Here's the thing. Gail, when you said people don't, well, you know what? But you do. And that's where it starts.
Mm-hmm.
And one reason I wrote this book is to equip people to be able to live in the solution and to be that person who does. And so, we could say, well, they do this in France and they do this in Canada, they do this in Massachusetts. But you know what? It all comes down to what you do. And you set a wonderful example when you asked the receptionist how she was, how her day is going. And your day set a great example when he talked to the person at the toll booth. And so that's really what it's about. So, what I would do is I'd more take on that, what can I do to make another person's life better, to just touch that other person in a nice way? And as you do this, you're going to get the results that Lisa was talking about earlier, and you're going to get the results that people who do these things. And what I do in the book is I tell stories because I want people to see how easy it is for you to be that one who does those things that not only touches another person's life in that way, but comes back to you many times over.
One of the phrases I like, and Bob Berg, we're very close to being out of time, but you say, be a judge, not a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is actually an old Talmudic expression. And the point is that as human beings, sometimes we take a position on something. something. And whether we're right or wrong, we just want to be right. And so, and that would be, of course, a lawyer. And, of course, a lawyer's paid to do that, to make their case, and that's fine when it's within the context of a courtroom. When we say be a judge, or when the sages said be a judge, what they mean is put yourself in the position where, not judgmental towards someone else, but where you can look at things from both sides and then make a decision based on being as objective as possible, not emotional.
Do we have time for another call? We don't.
No, I don't think we do.
Well, we've been speaking with Bob Berg. He is a speaker and he's author of several books. And his most recent is Adversaries into Allies, How to Win People Over Without Manipulation or Coercion. And your website is just BURG.com, is that right?
Yes, and they can download chapter one of the book to see if they like it when they go to the
site. And we'll also have links to the book at the Topical Currents Facebook page, as well as at our website, which is WLRN.org.
And we're sorry, Hannah, that we couldn't get to you.
I'm sorry, Hannah.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you, Bob.
Well, you both have been terrific. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. Pleasure.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information, links, photos, and discussion at the Topical Currents Facebook page. You can drop a like. Tomorrow's program is with Harvard professor Anita Elberse, author of Blockbusters, Hitmaking, Risk-Taking, and the Big Business of Entertainment. Microsoft backed the publication of Jay-Z's biography. Calendar. On this day in 1857, 156 years ago, the birth of author Joseph Conrad in Poland. He didn't learn English until his 20s, yet he wrote it in language. Heart of Darkness, Lord Jim, Under Western Eyes. And on this day in 1930, 83 years ago, the birth of singer Andy Williams in Wall Lake, Iowa. His popularity started on the old Steve Allen show in the 1950s. Andy Williams died last year with 18 gold records and 3 platinums. Remember Canadian Sunset, Moon River, It's a Wonderful Christmas. And one more while we recall Stella! On this day in 1947, 66 years ago, A Streetcar Named Desire by Tennessee Williams opens on Broadway, starring, of course, Marlon Brando and Jessica Tandy. So we leave with a line from Streetcar uttered by Blanche DuBois. If you'll forgive me, he's common. He's like an animal. He has an animal's habits. There's something subhuman about him. Thousands of years have passed him right by, and there he is, Stanley Kowalski, survivor of the Stone Age. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News.